Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June 29th. Today's session is titled Perspectives on the Land, Session 5, Christian Perspectives on the Land. It's presented by Esther Men, and the number is ME-2002-05. Let's listen in.
Haven't had to worry about having a place. As a matter of fact, they've taken places. And those who have other religions, ironically, that Paul Tillich would call pagan, have had their lands taken. Mm. I think there's an incredible irony there.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So this is a point worth pondering, if perhaps Christianity hasn't been more involved in land issues, for example, buildings and even in Christian nations, you know, taking places, other colonies and so forth. So maybe we need to be a little more intentional about the whole issue of land, to look at it critically. And I think that this is happening some in the last decades. And there's a reconsideration of biblical passages such as the creation narratives and some of the Psalms, focusing on creation in an attempt to think of this wonderful place, the world, God's world, as a place where we are stewards. You know, so the whole theme of ecology has come up, and attempts have been made to look at the Bible and find places where the care of the earth is important. So ecology is one theme. And another, besides the creation narratives, there's a whole body of biblical literature called wisdom literature that envisions God's wisdom as being present in all of creation. And therefore, there is a kind of an imminence of the divine in this world. So this is kind of a recent new thing, I think, within Christianity. And another strand of the reconsideration of the importance of the land, in addition to ecological themes, has been in reconsidering the role of predominantly Christian nations in political involvement in different parts of the world. And I think that one of the most important books from the 1970s was Walter Brueggemann's book On the Land, where he looks at the theme of the land in the Bible, and he says that it's amazing. Land is probably the most important theme in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, but also somewhat in the New Testament, after God and God's people. Land is really the important theme, central theme, and that we don't live a kind of a disembodied history that is apart from the land, right? That there's always a placed history. History always happens in a particular place. And so we can't imagine that we are somehow people of time and not people of space and place. And it's dishonest to think that we are. And there may even have been some kind of denial of some of the realities that have been taking place. Now, in his book, he looks at all of Israel's history, the different moments in its history, and he looks at how the land plays a part. So, for example, in Genesis 1 through 11, the major theme is expulsion from the land. So, expulsion from the Garden of Eden, or Cain sent wandering after his murder of Abel, or the flood, all the people drowning, but Noah moving in a boat to Mount Ararat, and in the Tower of Babel, all the peoples moving from Babel outward. So There's a forced, the idea of forced expulsion. And then starting with Abraham and the command, go from your country of your birth, from Ur, there's also a movement, but here it's not an expulsion so much, but it's a movement toward a promise. So it's more of a, not expulsion as punishment, but rather the departure from a known land, the risking of a landless state, and living in promise, moving towards a land. So he looks at many other examples, you know, of living in the wilderness for the 40 years without land, and yet surviving that and moving also, once again, towards land. Looks at land as gift and as temptation, something that we looked at when we looked at Deuteronomy 8 the first time that we met. Managed land, royal land, land that's used for the accumulation of wealth of a particular group. Land as never a constant. You know, it's not even something that a people has to have all the time, but it's something that people go into and out of, right? And there can be a risking of homelessness towards the gift of a home. There can also be a grasping of a land that in the end leads to homelessness. So he sees there kind of being a movement, a dialectic between what he calls the theology of glory, which is claiming the promised land, and the theology of the cross, which acknowledges God's homelessness, God's exile. So he says that we're always in a movement between these two, and you can't get caught in one or the other. Can't get caught in grasping for land. Neither should we idealize those who have no land as somehow in a state that is somehow desired by God. So he looks at land as a very complex kind of theme in the Bible. And we've been looking over this last week at a number of people's lives in the land. So the Lakota people's lives and connections with the land and their movement into the reservations and the shrinking of their land and their way of life. And now coming back with some of the lawsuits and so forth and reclaiming traditions and traditional associations. And we've also looked at our own association with the land, our love of the land, and most recently at the Jewish people and the Israelis' connection and claiming of that particular land is really a central agenda with their roots and their hopes in a particular land. And then yesterday we looked at the Palestinians and their connection as well. So for those who have land, using Brueggemann very loosely and just reflecting a little bit upon that, for those who have land, land can be considered not as something that is earned or that is appropriately, you know, one's because of one's own qualifications or anything, but rather land as gift and as, perhaps more importantly, as an arena for justice and for freedom. So we're back to Deuteronomy here with the gift of the land and all the temptations when you are in the land, to build and to amass and to think, oh, I have this success because I have made it, and then not to look at the way of life of justice and providing for all peoples out of the goodness of the land that will really allow the land to be a gift to all people. So for those who have land, there's this this demand really to use it as an arena for justice and freedom. And for those who don't have land, the dispossessed, this is not a virtue necessarily in and of itself. Poverty and homelessness isn't a state that should be seen as something permanent either, but rather taking the biblical witness, God wills land for his people. And he'll take it from others for the sake of the poor, for the sake of those who are dispossessed. So when Jesus quotes Psalm 37, he says, the poor or the meek will inherit the land. That's the good news for the poor. It's an incredible promise, isn't it, that those without land are heirs of the land, and so they can live in that hope. Now, we could look at a number of biblical passages that deal with the land and envision some kind of just and productive and fair use of the land. For example, the idea of the Jubilee year in Leviticus 25. The vision of the Jubilee year is that after 7 weeks of years, or 49 years, every 49 years, that's about a generation or so, all the land that's been amassed by particular individuals goes back to its traditional ownership by families into small kind of plots. So the ideal is that every family, every unit has enough, but no one has the power to accumulate, at least not for a long period of time. Now the Jubilee probably was an idealization of how things should be. There's no indication that it ever happened.
Too workable.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's not too workable.
It's not too workable.
It's an ideal.
It's an ideal, yes. So it's a use of the imagination. How could we ensure that everyone would have enough land and nobody, you know, would be able to hoard and to create situations of homelessness? So just the imagination of that, I think, is a good start, anyway, to imagine that there could be some other way. So it's a helpful concept, and it's been used, the concept of the Jubilee year has been used a lot in recent years to talk about relief of debt by poor countries, and issues of land distribution and so forth. So it doesn't really provide a workable program, but the concept, I think, is a good one. It you know, you can also criticize it on other grounds too, that the land is reverts to traditional families that owned it before. So you have a kind of a defined group of people that the land continues to go back to, and it may be exclusionary of other groups and so forth. So it's one attempt to kind of imagine how things could be different that can kind of inform our attempts at fair land usage. The other passage that I want to read to you, we could look at so many other ones, for example, the vision of the new heaven and earth that Revelation 21 to 22 calls for and so forth. But the one that I want to offer us is in Micah, the prophet Micah, who lived in the 8th century before the Common Era, in a time when there was a lot of growth a big property ownership. So the small farms were being bought out by wealthy individuals, much as you know we've had happen over the last decades in our own country. And so after the farmers were driven off, they of course were very poor. But his vision is that God will judge between many peoples and shall arbitrate between strong nations far away. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore, but they shall sit each under their own vines and under their own fig trees, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. So Micah's vision, also an imaginative vision, how could things be different? Well, he envisions God's rule and fair judgment, and the people turning their implements of war into implements of agriculture, swords into plowshares, or spears into pruning hooks. And then his vision is that they sit in their gardens, right, under their own vines and fig trees. So that kind of an agricultural ideal of everyone having a place, sort of a sustainable place that would grow fruits and so forth. So these are just a couple of visions, not really programs, right? They're not workable programs, how to get to that vision, but they're ideals that can inform how we view the land.
That passage reminds me almost of a return to the Garden of Eden, where everything was the way it should be, with the right relationship with God and all of creation. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I was thinking about when you were talking is, I've thought about this over all the days, is that land throughout history has seemed to represent power and wealth, mm-hmm. because so many of the invaders from whatever country they might be have gone to other continents to take the land. They weren't so interested in what people were there because they weren't interested in changing culture. I mean, this is a big generalization, but they were interested in expanding their territory for mm-hmm. their king or for themselves or whatever. And then even in our own history, the landowners in the South or the landowners in Europe would build the big homes and have acres or miles of land, and they were considered the wealthy ones, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In contrast. And then related to that, I'm not certain if this is a point you would come to, and I hope that I don't sound naive, but I've been wondering about this forever. Why currently Israeli Jewish population is so intent on having certain boundaries for themselves, and is that because those boundaries that they wish to have are the original ones that God promised them, and so therefore there is no possibility of peace because no one else owns this land. God promised it to us, the Jews. Therefore we will do what we need to do to get it because we've been promised it from time immemorial. Mm-hmm. And that, if that is the true base level motivation in all this political rhetoric and all the militaristic things that are going on, then that's not a very hopeful thing for the Palestinians at all, who also have a right to the land, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whether they're Arabs or Jews. Mm. Or Christians, mm. mm-hmm. that want to live there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for your reflections, which brings us to back to the crisis in the Middle East, and maybe we can pick up there. I really appreciate your kind of summarizing some of the things that you've been thinking about through the week. And before we turn to the Middle East specifically, does anybody else have anything that they want to say about these biblical visions or anything that we've touched upon so far? All right, well then let's go on to back to the crisis in Israel, Palestine. And you raised the question of what is the status of the land over there? Whose is it? And what is a Christian's response to that situation over there? And many Christians, especially of the more conservative or the religious right, some of the more fundamentalist Christians, fully support Israel and in its greater borders of all Israel. And they agree that the land of Israel is an unconditional gift to the Jewish people, that it's the promised land, land promised to Abraham and all of Abraham's descendants. And so they view scripture as a kind of a land deed, right? As a legal document. Mm-hmm. And some of these Christians who support Israel have messianic associations with the return of the Jews to this particular land, because they envision that with the return to the land, this brings closer the coming kingdom of God. So there are Christians who do unconditionally support Israel, and really don't pay attention to the situation of the Palestinians there. On the other hand, there are Christians that really emphasize the plight of the Palestinians and deeply empathize with them as the poor, the victimized, the oppressed. So especially Christians that are coming out of a liberation theology perspective. You see Israel as really the aggressor, and the task is to align themselves with the Palestinians to get back the land, you know, which would be just and so forth. And I agree with that camp to a certain extent, but what I would really want to see from Christians is I would want to see us to continue to mourn for the tragedy on both sides. And to really feel that deeply, you know, and to be able to read of suicide bombings and the kind of living in fear that means, and to be able to weep about that. And then to be able to read about the tanks that are coming into the cities, and the curfews and the mass arrests, and to be able to weep about that too. So to really feel deeply the losses on both sides, and also to understand the issues on both sides as much as possible. So to recognize, for example, the historic connections of the Jewish people to that land, to really fully grasp that, and to sense, if you are ever able to go over there, to sense the joy of the Jewish people on that land, especially the more religious people, but others as well. And also to the concerns of safety and survival for the Jewish people, coming out of just 50 years ago or so, pretty much the destruction of all European Jewry, and the determination to have a safe haven, to have a place where they're secure, because no one helped them in the Second World War. So there's this feeling that they need some place, some haven of safety. So to be able to really feel that and understand what motivates what's going on there, I think is very important. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to agree that what they're doing over there is going to lead to the kind of safety that they need so much. We may criticize the policies and so forth. But if we can understand that, that's very important. And then on the other hand, to really understand the situation of the Palestinians, how so many were driven off their land, and how the loss of their families' lands, the loss of their traditional way of life, the generations in the refugee camps, the kind of anger and hatred that builds, you know, to understand that too deeply is very important, because this history of dispossession is continuing even in our own time with the growth of the settlements and so forth. And we just see so much poverty and broken institutions, families, the humiliation. You know, I saw so much humiliation over there of the Palestinian people at border crossings, where there would just be lines. You'd have one-hour wait at border crossings and so forth, and just a lot of humiliation there. People who had grown up in East Jerusalem, for example, would be trying to cross into East Jerusalem from Bethlehem or someplace like that, and they wouldn't be able to, they'd be turned back, whereas someone who had come more recently from Russia, you know, a Jewish person who had made Aliyah would have the right papers and so forth and would get through quickly. I mean, just the humiliation is incredible. So if we can understand that too deeply, I think that will allow us to be a presence that can accompany and can speak out and can really try to discern with both sides the paths that will lead to some kind of peaceful and just and life-giving arrangement on the land. And you know, we can't really do it all from out here. We can try, and I know Colin Powell is calling for the Palestinian state, and now Bush is as well. And so, you know, our government does give a lot of money over there, $3 billion or so to Israel. And I would hope that in the future we would invest a lot of money in the Palestinian state as well, to build up its infrastructure and schools and, you know, all of its things that it needs for a valid economy and so forth. I would hope that we would do that. That would be something that we would be able to do over here. But what I thought that I would do in some of the remaining time that we have is to read a few things from Christians that have decided to accompany and to speak out and to remain involved. The first thing I thought I would read and ask you if you've heard is Bishop Mark Hansen's Middle East statement. Have you all, how many people have read that?
Pastors are supposed to
read it. Yes, okay, good. So how many people have didn't even know there was such a statement? Okay, great, thank you. I just wanted to take that hand check because our presiding bishop of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, Mark Hansen, wrote a statement on April 4th. It was a Middle East statement, and he wrote it in that period, if you remember, in March and April. That was when, after a series of suicide bombings, including one at a Passover celebration, tanks went into all of the major areas of Palestinian control. Ramallah, Bethlehem, Qalqilya, Nablus, Jenin, Hebron, Jericho, so all those areas. And so he responded, and then he emailed all synod offices asking them to distribute it electronically to their congregation so that it might be read at or distributed during every ELCA congregation's worship service on April 7th, but I know that didn't happen to my congregation either. So anyway, but he is trying to address this. What, you know, what can you do when something like this is happening? A very violent situation. Okay, so this is his statement, and you can get it on the web under elca.org. You can find it. When a Passover meal becomes a bloody massacre, when the site of Jesus' birth is turned into a place of violence, when religious sanctuaries become battlegrounds for war, people of faith cannot remain silent. The Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, in America, is deeply concerned about current events in the occupied territories of the West Bank. The violence that we all have witnessed through the media is unacceptable, no matter who may be at fault. It is time for Israelis and Palestinians to end this violent conflict, to stop killing each other, to stop the destruction of property, including church buildings, to lay down their arms and to engage in a process that leads to peace. I have called on President Bush and Secretary Powell to use their great influence to halt this dreadful and violent situation. And there's note C, the April 2nd letter to President Bush, which I also have. And basically, it reiterates what's here. While we are concerned for the welfare of all people, I'm especially concerned for our brothers and sisters of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and Palestine, the ELCJ. Their safety has been jeopardized. Basic needs such as food, water, and medicine have been cut off. Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem has been damaged, was occupied by Israeli soldiers, and its pastor held hostage for a few hours before the soldiers left. Actions such as these are totally unacceptable. The ELCA has responded to this crisis by providing $20,000, as a gift to the ELCJ through International Disaster Relief to be used for food, water, and medicine. Another $100,000 has been provided for relief services to the Lutheran World Federation's Augusta Victoria Hospital in Jerusalem, the Middle East Council of Churches, and the Near East Council of Churches Committee for Refugee Work in Gaza. In this difficult time in the Holy Land, I call upon the members of the ELCA, so us here, to, and he lists three things, pray fervently for peace for all people in the region. That's number one, pray. And in some of the materials that I've received from the web and through email, Bishop Yunan of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Jordan and Mitri Raheb, the pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem, they talk about how important the prayers of people from around the world are for them because they're living in such a time of crisis, so much pressure, so much violence, so much temptation, I think, to give in to hatred and to despair. Mm-hmm. And so they really do talk seriously about how the prayers of people around the world and the expressions, the letters and so forth, that they really, they keep them up. So take this one seriously. Okay, beyond praying for the peace for all people in the region, the second is pray for U.S. leaders that they may be filled with the wisdom to find a peaceful solution to the violence. And then the third is to write to senators and representatives and President Bush, urging them to use their offices to seek an immediate ceasefire and provide for an international presence to provide for and maintain a lasting peace. So those are the three things that Mark Hansen asks us to do in this time. Any reactions? Yes.
I'd like to comment. I've been looking for a number of days for something positive in the recent position statement of President Bush relative to that temporary Palestinian state. On the negative side, I've essentially felt that it's given a kind of a tacit permission to Sharon to do as he pleased. On the positive side, the study here that you're doing, we could say at least that he perhaps, I don't know that he is recognizing the centrality of land in the issue. Mm-hmm. Apart from the political kind of thing, mm-hmm. You've helped me think today that perhaps land is the one spot where perhaps insight, inspiration, world pressure can bring more resolution. The continual flap about ending violence is not doing it, will not do it. There's no justice there, there's no equality. But, you know, the land, which would be the dissolution of the settlements and the return of the refugees to their land, suddenly land becomes the key element in the process. And as we write, it might be from the Christian perspective, calling attention to the biblical kind of thing, that we could emphasize that kind of thing. You know, a temporary Palestinian state fenced in by the Israeli anger is not going to bring even temporary, much less permanent resolution.
Mm-hmm. Just 'cause there's no addressing of issues such as water rights and that, nor any kind of contact with the outside world for economic viability, or so there's all those issues still remaining. But you're directing our attention to the fact that the whole issue of land is so important for the continued existence of a people.
Well, and you know, while I really think there's a whole lot more Israelis who believe this than would be given evidence by Sharon's response, but they see, as well as the Palestinians, that land is the means by which security could be, you know, a fence is one way, but a designation of a Palestinian state and the issue of land is a much more viable way of providing security than is a fence, even though that fence around Gaza has, you know, temporarily kept people in, but at the same time raises the anger and the hostility and continues the oppression of the people who are behind the fence.
Right. And those are such close neighbors. You don't want to have that kind of hatred between such close neighbors. It's somehow that we got to move beyond this kind of use of military force and violence to try to achieve peace, because if it works, it's only very temporarily. So yeah, the issue of land still remains, and the kind of life that it gives. Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, it seems to me what Hansen's statement doesn't recognize is that the intentions of the intentions of Israelis is ethnic cleansing, not the entire population. As you brought out really, really well, it's very controversial, but the overall effect of many months of years of putting in the settlements, which has been more, from what I can tell, had a military effect of dividing up the land, putting in the roads, connecting them, has been a very nice military way of controlling the land. And eventually, there's the dream that peace can be brought when your opponent is dead. That your opponent no longer has a voice, because your opponent can no longer speak. They're gone. And I think there are enough people in our government that also share that dream. Once the Palestinians no longer have a land and a voice and have been dispersed and killed, then we can pursue other objectives year round and round.
Phew.
You know, I know I would love to think that you've had a wonderful dream, but I really fear that there's the major goal is simply to have them be gone, and we're quietly, and there are some people that really want that too in our government, and their voices are also quietly had
Come straight.
That's my problem with Bishop Hansen's statement.
Is that you think it doesn't go far enough?
It doesn't recognize a really horrible reality. And that's also not saying that's not to say that the Israelis certainly are not a terrorized population. I love what Rabbi Mark said. He was so profound, and you're saying exactly the same thing, to hear all voices and to understand.
And really, when I was over there, you had such range of opinion. I mean, I know that the building in which I lived, it was owned by the Yuval family. They come in the 1950s in West Jerusalem. And, there was a school bus, a car passed a school bus and blew it up and so forth. And I asked about that, and they said, well, that's in the territories. We don't think that we have any right to be over in the territories. Those people are taking that risk. We don't think they should be there. So in other words, the population is really quite divided.
Right.
And even there's a majority that sees that there needs to be a Palestinian state. And move in that direction. But you're absolutely right that the effect of the policies and the violence has been to drive out the people with means, the Palestinians with means, that are able to leave. And then it's very difficult to come back, to re-enter. I know in Chicago, in Hyde Park, where I am, there's a man who owns restaurants now. But he came over from the Gaza Strip, and he eventually brought over his mother and father, and he has like 11 brothers. He brought them over one by one, and his father was kind of the mayor of this little town, and they lived in houses that were like the family lived all together, and they have a traditional way of living with the family. So that's all gone now, and they're out of there because he was able to get them out. It's just so violent. There's no prospects. 50% to 80% unemployment, and just the grinding poverty. And I asked him, well, what do you think about what's happening? He says, I don't even think about it. I don't want to think about it. So the people that are able, and especially Palestinian Christians, are leaving in greater numbers because they tend to be more educated and have more means, and so they just keep draining off. So the effect of the policies and the violence, continued disruption of the schools and everything, really is to drain off the best, the leadership off the land, and to leave the poorest and the least able to organize there. Yes?
I have two things. And the first is that it's always really important to me to distinguish between the intentions of the leaders and the intentions of the people. Mm-hmm. And that's when citizen diplomacy becomes imperative, is that we are on a human level connecting with Jewish people and connecting with Palestinians, and that they're connecting with each other, and that's happening. And what we perceive and what our media tells us is that it's Sharon and Arafat and Bush and Powell, and like all these guys are butting heads. And while that's true, there's like masses of people that are interacting and have the potential to realize each other's human potential too. And that's when true and lasting security is going to come. The second thing I wanted to share, I haven't been here for all of your sessions, but you mentioned Lakota, that you spent some time looking at the Lakota people. I taught Native American history from a Native perspective last year in the Midwest to Lakota kids and to Ojibwe kids. And I'm not doing that anymore this year, but as soon as this stuff started happening in Israel and Palestine, it hit me like right here in the gut. And I had a dream, and I saw like piles of buffalo skulls, and then it flashed uprooted olive trees. And then I saw tobacco pipes and eagle feathers desecrated, and I saw the Church of the Nativity. And I saw like people at Sand Creek and Munduni, and I saw Janine. And I had friends that were over there that were doing accompaniment work. And I think that's where those images came from. And I kept thinking last year as I was teaching this history, and as those kids were calling me on stuff left and right, like what were my ancestors doing during that time? Were they participating in it? Or were they doing something about it? I think it's our call as Christians and as humans to reach out to the human in each other, the God in you, and to connect on that level, because our leaders are going to do sort of what our leaders are going to do, and we have to, because they're, my feeling is that they're motivated by more than just sort of like the search for the human potential in other people. And so while we need to call them and hold them accountable to what we want, we also have to be interacting on a person-to-person level. Mm-hmm. So that's...
I think that is so important. And one of the biggest tragedies over there right now, I think, is this... are these crossings and this barbed wire that's going on, these trenches and this wall that's being constructed, because that's going to limit any kind of contact between Israelis and Palestinians. And so already that's happened, so that you can live. When I was living in West Jerusalem, people in West Jerusalem didn't go to East Jerusalem. And I stopped taking the taxis because they would give me such a hard time for going over to East Jerusalem. I just walk, and it's only an hour walk, you know, from, but it's like two different worlds, and they don't mix at all, and they don't know each other. And so various groups, there's groups of supported by some of the women to that involve childcare and so forth, getting together, you know, children at a young age, or there's some schools and so forth that have peace as their goal, Seeds for Peace and others. And that is so important, to know the other as a person instead of as, you know, an idea or as the enemy. And I think that that's one thing that the Christian Arabs are very keen on doing too. And I've been so impressed with the statements. I have a couple of them here, but you know, we don't have a lot of time. I really appreciate your comments. But Mitri Raheb, where he talks about winning the enemy. So he doesn't talk about winning the war, but winning the enemy, turning the enemy into a neighbor. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Aren't there quite a few Palestinians living in Israel proper, not just in the settlements?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So that means that a lot of these fences and these walls are separating families.
Right. And exactly. Separating families and relatives. Mm-hmm. That's very true. Yes. Uh-huh. So, for example, to get from Hebron to Jerusalem, very difficult. Now, and the family that I knew, the Palestinian family I knew, lived in East Jerusalem, and they would sometimes go to Hebron, but it just took longer and longer with these borders. And if these barbed wire enclosures are put up with, you know, you need permits to go out and so forth, I mean, it's just going to make it very, very difficult. It's really heart-wrenching. Well, you know, you can all learn a lot more about this. There's ecumenical accompaniment programs where you can actually go over there for a while. I have information here about that. You can also get information from the web. There's something called the Middle East Resource, or you can look up Holyland-Lutherans or ELCA.org and look under Middle East, and they have a lot of information, especially from the point of view of the Palestinian Christians and especially the Lutherans. So we have a little bit of a kind of a window into what's happening over there through the Lutheran connection. And also there are groups that are there, American and Canadian groups, English-speaking groups. You can get on their email list and they'll send you reports. For example, there's one called the Christian Peacemaker Teams, and they're stationed in Hebron. And what they do is they say that they promote peace by, they are essentially a project of the Mennonite Church USA and the Mennonite Church Canada, Church of the Brethren and Friends United Meeting, and other Christians. And they say that they are an organization committed to reducing violence by getting in the way. Challenging systems of domination and exploitation as Jesus Christ did in the first century. So they're stationed in Hebron, but you get reports of what they see and what they do, and they're able to take food to people that are in curfew, lockdown and curfew. They're able to walk with people through the crossing borders and, you know, ask questions. They're nonviolent, but, or if they see people fighting, they go up, they can go up to them and question them or, you know, depending on the situation, intervene by standing in the way. So that's a rather inspiring group.
Have you mentioned Christians for Middle East Peace, CMEP?
Thank you. Christians for Middle East Peace. Say more about that.
Well, it's another web source, mm-hmm. and provides reports and lots of inside kinds of things that you don't obviously get in the media. And another one, Friends of Sabeel.
Friends of Sabeel. I was going to mention Sabeel.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But go ahead, say something about Sabeel.
Well, it's one of those local things that is being supported and encouraged by friends in North America, U.S. and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The name of Naim Matik is associated there, who I think one of those that has the greatest insights into issues such as you've been talking about, like land and justice and equality.
Mm-hmm.
And used to spend 3 months there and used to invite that Hebron group to meet with the discussion group after worship at St. George Church.
Mm-hmm.
A moving thing. You talked about courage, you know, some mm-hmm. of those people that would stand in the way of the bulldozers so that a Palestinian family's house would not be bulldozed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. It's really, really impressive, especially in light of the fact that the Israeli government is so adamant about not inviting in an international group of observers, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is good to have people there that are able to mm-hmm. tell what they see.
I think their mm-hmm. intrusion was one of the elements that broke the hold at the Church of the Nativity. It was when the outsiders got in with the cell phones and the media began to hear something of what was going on inside.
Mm-hmm. That's so important because we don't hear. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll, as a closing, for the next minute, I will just read you something that was written by Naim Atik from the Sabeel Ecumenical Liberation Theology Center in Jerusalem. He writes with such just hope in a horrendous time of mm-hmm. violence and terror, and he lists all the things, you know, that are happening. And says that from our perspective of faith, all killing is wrong. The killing of innocent people can never be justified, but extrajudicial killing is also wrong. Suspects must be brought to justice and given a fair trial. The killing of Palestinians and Israelis is a crime, whether perpetrated by the Israeli extremist government through its army and settlers, or by Palestinians who are resisting the occupation of their country. We condemn both acts as evil. And simultaneously reiterate our strong conviction that the Israeli illegal occupation is the root cause of the problem. So long as it lasts, violence and terror are likely to continue. We believe that the evil and oppressive occupation must be resisted consistently with nonviolent direct action. We at Sabeel stand for nonviolence because it stems from our understanding of the gospel. We therefore call for people of goodwill throughout the world who believe that justice is the true basis for peace to employ all the nonviolent means possible to bring the Israeli occupation to an end. And then he has a little meditation. Will you allow me one more minute?
Sure.
Where he becomes more biblical and theological. Throughout this year, with the increase of Israel's repressive measures and Palestinian resistance, we have been walking through the valley of the shadow of death. In fact, the words of the funeral service are very apt. In the midst of life, we are in death. Human beings created in the image of the one merciful and loving God deserve a much better life. Their humanity, of which they have been stripped by grave injustice must be restored, and their dignity, trampled and denied by oppression, must be reaffirmed. One of the great marks of Christmas is its note of hope. This is actually a Christmas letter. For in the midst of the utter darkness of a world of sin and evil, God shines on humanity with the gift of hope in the incarnation of our Lord Jesus Christ. Hope for a life that can be lived with God and neighbor fully and abundantly in peace and in love. The final words of the Song of Zechariah have a special meaning for us during this Christmas season: to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace. This is our prayer as well as our plea. At certain times in the struggle for peace, our people were able to see a light at the end of the tunnel. Many of us today see a tunnel that has no end, shrouded with gloom and utter darkness, the darkness of injustice and humiliation. In the midst of such despair, our prayer to the incarnate Lord is to give us that ray of light that will restore hope and confidence for a brighter future for all the people of our land, so that our feet will be guided in the way of peace. At this Christmas, we share with you our prayer, and we plead that you will do everything you can to help put an end to the occupation of our country. Our people are longing for a life of security and peace in their own state, and wish the same for their Israeli neighbors. And the most hope that I see over there is from these Christian Palestinian voices, as well as the Israeli peace activists. But they really are the light in what seems a very dark night. And if there's anything that any of you can do to, whether through your prayers or letters or financial support, anything like that, your presence over there, I'd urge you to take that action. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I hope you write up your dream. Did you write it up?
Yeah.